And now we present to you Thacko with Advantage.
Welcome to Thacko with Advantage. We're two friends who've been playing D&D a long time. While we both love lots of other RPGs, D&D has taught us to fill empty voids with creative material. Hi, I'm Ange, and I have been gaming for over 35 years. In 2014, I started writing for Gnome Stew, and I've been running the Gnomecast Stew's podcast since 2017. 2021, I became head gnome. I've been doing this for a while, and I like to talk about it, so that's why I'm here.
And I'm Jared, the review gnome at Gnome Stew, and when I started playing D&D, the only reason anyone profiled players was to convince the judge to give them a warrant. I write reviews at Gnome Stew, and I've got my own site, whatdoinojr.com, where I house additional reviews and opinion pieces. After we look at the games that we're running in the campaign journal, we'll be talking about identifying and using player types. Then we'll have some recommendations of D&D-related content for you to check out in our downtime research segment.
Now stand by for station identification. This is WDND The Role Player. Now we're going to McElroy McKinney and the Bardic College.
In most editions of Dungeons & Dragons, there has been a Player's Handbook and a Dungeon Master's Guide. But two editions of D&D bucked this trend. D&D 3rd Edition had a Dungeon Master's Guide 2 and a Player's Handbook 2, and D&D 4th Edition had a Dungeon Master's Guide 2 as well as a Player's Handbook 2 and a Player's Handbook 3. But isn't every book actually an iteration of the Rules Compendium from a certain point of view? I think I'm going to start calling the 2024 Player's Handbook the Rules Compendium 23.
Let me just finish up this campaign journal.
So, campaign journal, I got to both play and run since we last recorded. In the Poison Kingdom game, we took some time to discuss what we were going to do next because we had technically accomplished what we had originally set out to do, which was find out what happened to the outpost, and then what happened to the guard captain from the outpost, which we had done. That's when we found out our Nox, our blind fighter, based on the player's blind cat, knew that his siblings were further out into the poison land, and he wanted to go rescue them. And he was going to go do this regardless of whether or not we helped him. So we all agreed that we would continue on to go find Nox's siblings and see if we could find out what was making things worse in the swamp and starting to spread outward into the healthy lands. Obviously, we're adventurers, we're going to take the hook, but we wanted to have that in-character conversation to make sure we were all, you know, doing it for the right reasons and not just because the adventure is obviously in that direction. The rest of the session was some travel with an encounter with some renegade bandits pretending to be druids, or druids pretending to be bandits, or some combination thereof. They were really dumb criminals, and we kind of beat the crap out of them, and the one that survived and explained what they had been doing, we kind of kicked his butt, scared him to the nine hells, and basically sent him back to the healthy lands to live a good life as an upstanding citizen. We also had some environmental encounters where we had a magical storm kind of chasing us, and we had to cross this bog in a certain number of turns to escape it. You know, it was less basically playing with some of the ideas for encounters that weren't just find monster, kill monster.
Mm-hmm.
Next session, we are in person again, which I am super excited about because it's going to be a little different. We're actually going to be playing earlier in the afternoon and then all going to dinner together afterwards. So maybe since I know we're going to be going out to dinner together after we wrap up gaming around 6 o'clock, I'll be less distracted while we're playing in person. Don't count on it. Don't count on it. I also have had the first full session of my Tales of the Old Margreave game. Unfortunately, we were down a player to start. The player had his work holiday gathering this late into January. I know some companies do it. Whatever. It was his holiday gathering. He didn't want to miss it. It was good networking opportunities, so on and so forth. So I totally understand him wanting to be there. It just sucked that, you know, it's so hard to schedule games, and I didn't want to skip the first session, but I also wanted to be there. But I ended up having to figure out what to do with his character. He's playing Malvern the Rogue. I didn't want to have him just standing there like a brick in the background of heavy role-playing scenes. So what I ended up deciding is that he just wasn't going to be there for the first part of the session.
Mm-hmm.
The way I set this up is because I paired off all of the characters. I gave each set a scene prior to the beginning of prior to the beginning of the meat of the story,
yeah,
where they were basically given the mission to go to the Riven Sky Brewery and talk to somebody. With Dahlia and Turvin, the elf-touched ranger and the elven rogue, I had a forest spirit that they had befriended back in the Arbanes Forest direct them to go to the Margreave because there was a sickness there that they needed to fix. As they got closer, I had Iko, the forest spirit, show up and give them more specific directions, which, of course, from a forest spirit, were not specific at all. She told them to go to the broken sky above the amber gold in that direction. And, of course, they arrive at the Riven Sky Brewery and they see a sign of a kind of a broken sky above amber fields. And they're like, I think this is what she meant. With Nevrem and Zartath, the Sidereian warlock and the kobold wizard, they were called to a meeting with Lady Fennel, who is Zobek's spymaster. Part of the backstory was is she had caught them doing something they weren't supposed to be doing in the past, and seeing their potential, she has used them for a few different jobs. They are completely unsuited to becoming spies in her organization, but she is still, you know, willing to make use of various assets, including them. And it was insinuated in her conversation with them that she was sending them to meet with somebody that she used to adventure with in her youth. Because she sent them to meet with a woman named Lorelia Devarian, supposedly a bard. They didn't know anything. Just go to the Riven Sky Brewery, talk to her. With Grish and Malvern, the human cousins that are fighter and rogue, they had established in their background that they occasionally did jobs with and for Snow, who is a Shadow Fae apprentice to Consular Streck. And since he had given them jobs before, he came to them and said, go do this. The next morning, you know, it's like you're starting out on your journey. And I said that Grish got a note from Malvern saying that he would catch up later, and insinuated that Malvern has some issues with some thieves in the city of Zobek that he has to deal with before he can leave. All five of them ended up getting to the Riven Sky Brewery, meeting there, had some fun interactions with the NPCs as they talked to Lorelia and found out the whole situation. Lorelia is set up as a former adventuring bard who was cursed and is part of the curse, lost her sight but gained a seer's visions and insight. She has settled down at the inn, which is I have set up as the first coaching inn along the northern road. She has settled there with her wife, who is a tiefling fighter or barbarian type who has taken up as the cook. And I modeled her very much on Ilona Meyer, just because I'm like, I want a big, tough, beefy woman in this role, and had some fun with her trying to encourage people to try some of her spicier dishes because nobody likes to eat food as spicy as she likes to make it. In addition to the dwarven couple that ran the place, there was also an alehouse drake. We had a very fun scene where Turvin cast Speak with Animals to go up and speak with the alehouse drake, who immediately took offense that he was being treated like an animal because he speaks both common and draconic. And they were all like, oh, what is it? I don't understand what an alehouse drake is. So we had to have a little bit of an explanation of what alehouse drakes are. Anyway, tiny, tiny bit of haggling for them to, on what they were going to get paid to go on this mission. But they were asked to go to the village of Lavoka because Lorelia felt that that was where the source of there was something happening there that was part of this malaise that was going to be coming over the Margreave Forest. Started off on a journey as they passed back by Zobek. Malvern comes running out of it and catch up with him. be run as an NPC for the rest of the session, about halfway to where they're going, because it was about 3 days travel based on the distance. And to be fair, I moved Lavoca from where it's supposed to be on the map, because where it's supposed to be on the map is on the far side of Margrave Forest from where Zobek is. And as far as I could tell from combing through the book, there's no real reason it needs to be there. And I didn't want my players spending a month at first level traveling from the city to the location where the adventure is, because it's supposed to be an adventure for first level characters. Just like, I'm not gonna redline it. I'm just gonna move the village closer to Zobek. So it's about 3 days travel. They had a run in with some bandits on the road. Again, stupid bandits. It's a theme of D&D games. And then they got into the forest, and I got to make use of the forest's. There's basically an attitude that the forest can have towards you. And I had had each player roll a d6 and add their charisma modifier to it. And then I use that to add to other things that are established based on their species, their class, certain things like that. Zartath is lucky he's a wizard, because that got him a +1, because otherwise he almost would be starting out at a level that would get negative consequences from the forest. Meanwhile, Dahlia is actually already into the next tier of attitude, because elf-touched ranger rolled really well and has a decent charisma. So she already, like, Zartath walked into the forest and immediately felt like he was being watched suspiciously, that he's not sure he's safe, you know, this kind of uncomfortable feeling. And Dolly is like, this is home. This place is welcoming. I like this place. And then we had one last little encounter before we ended the session. And that was, they came across a buck, a deer, who was basically being driven mad and had killed a fox. Has blood on the horns and on the fur and all this, and is obviously enraged. And they subdued the deer, and we're going to have a conversation with it. Funny point, Turvin was so excited to have speak with animals that he cast it to talk with the Alehouse Drake. But then we get to the scene, and he was hesitating on whether to cast it to talk to the deer. Thankfully, one of the other players looked, dude, you wanted that spell so bad. Here is a thing you can use it on. And just as he was about to cast it, Malvern's player showed up getting home from his work event. And so the game kind of got derailed. And we said, we'll deal with talking with the deer in the next session. And then just got Malvern caught up and chit-chatted the rest of the night.
You know, as part of our recent tradition of thinking of potential future topics as we're going through these things, we should probably see if there is a topic in there about doing those framing introductions before the campaign actually starts.
Yeah.
Because I have done that a lot. I did that with my Curse of Strahd game. And I think that's probably maybe kind of worth looking into, where you want something where people are going to role play and interact, but it's not so much the beginning of the campaign so much as the framing piece for the campaign.
Yeah, it eases them into their characters, so that when you do have the actual opening of the campaign, you don't end up with 4 to 6 people just staring at you, uncertain of what to do. They already have a little comfort level in their characters and can dive right into the role playing.
It's almost like the beginning of the Lord of the Rings, except it's not 11 years of Frodo setting up real estate deals before he leaves the Shire. I love those books, but seriously. We played Curse of Strahd back to back, so I don't remember what I have talked about and what I didn't talk about on the show, but that's okay, because mainly I was going to talk about our Thrones and Bones game that we did, which is completely using Tales of the Valiant, and we are running that via Shard, and we had that last Saturday. We've been playing through the introductory adventure for the Thrones and Bones setting, which is Banner of the Bull, and we had a bit of a gap between sessions, because this one was essentially going to be a monthly game on a Saturday. When you miss sessions and it's already a monthly game, it tends to be drawn out a bit. So
Yeah, and we missed in December because December.
Yeah, definitely. So I made like a checklist of everything just to remind everybody where they were at. Last time, they were still in the Trelleborg in the fortress on the borderlands, and they were staring down a black goat. And the funny thing about this is, they were staring down a black goat about ready to get into a fight. My Curse of Strahd game, the last thing they did was fight a black goat. For a moment, I was wondering, is there something with me and black goats?
Bah.
No, it's not me. These are both published adventures. I'm running published adventures. Black goats found me. Technically, the black goat that they were fighting was a Pooka, I think is how that's pronounced. It is a malicious trickster fairy. It is the type of trickster fairy that is okay with people getting hurt, even if that's not the main thing that it's trying to do. And it was very upset with them because the party ruined its fun because they ran off all of the other fae in the fortress. Part of this was we have not had a ton of fights in this adventure so far. We had the bandit fight, which was kind of just a warm up. It wasn't really a threat. We had the cats, which the cat fight was really that not really a fight. It was in initiative, but it was more of a puzzle trying to maneuver them to certain areas and not getting thrown in the river.
Yeah, that was more of a skill challenge. I mean, it was kind of a blend of it wasn't a combat, but it wasn't quite a skill challenge.
Yeah.
Somewhere in between those two.
I do still like the fact that because they're immune to force damage, they bounce when you hit them with force damage. But they fought the Pooka, and I had a little bit of fun. I had it like using its Misty Step to move around a little bit so that it wasn't trapped in the room. It still was not going to defeat all of these people. It was being irrational on purpose. So they beat it down and it did not have a good day.
It was a little too stupid to save one of its Misty Steps.
Yeah.
To get away. So it basically like Misty Stepped, annoyed us. Misty Stepped, annoyed us. And then got cornered.
Yeah, and this was the GM intentionally playing to what its intelligence score was. This wasn't just me forgetting what tactics were. It was, no, this is a fae that got carried away and got himself into more trouble than he should have. So after they dispatched the poor Pooka, they went to find where the lost soldier from the Trelleborg first met the fae, because that location was detailed in her journey. They get out there to the hill, and on top of the hill is this maze just made out of thorny hedges.
It was so annoying because we're very obviously, this is very much an aspect of VTT games.
Mm-hmm.
We're very obviously at the bottom of a large map.
Yes.
And it's like, okay, we have a hedge wall in front of us. Let's find an opening. We find the opening. Jared reveals just the tiniest bit more of the map. And it's like, aw, son of a bitch, it's a maze.
It is funny because I normally am not thrilled with running mazes, but I do like, this is weird how presentation can change your mindset on something, because I like how they've structured this adventure in Shard, because when you unfog something, it basically unfogs a corridor. So if somebody comes around the corner, it unfogs that whole corridor. So I'm not trying to explain to you, oh, you can kind of see something over here, but it's over here. It's like, it is obvious that you can see all the way down to the end of the corridor and you can turn off to the left.
Yeah.
So I like that. It made me a little bit more happy about running a maze in this case. The other thing that I think is funny is they do have the rage quit option for the maze, where you can just get mad and walk through the hedges, but you take damage from the thorns.
I mean, we're still only second level characters. We could maybe do that through one wall. As you said, it's like 1d6.
No, it was 2d4.
Maybe it's just scratch.
Yeah.
Maybe it's, you know, our warlock is bleeding on the ground.
Yeah, and also you have one of those groups that it's not devoid of healing, but you don't have a centralized cleric. You have a druid and a paladin.
Yep.
You have healing. It's just not quite the same as having a cleric where it's all focused in one place.
And my paladin is out of lay on hands because we made the decision to only take a short rest before leaving Trelleborg to head up here. And I'm like, okay, guys, I'm not gonna push back on that one.
Part of it is too, there is an unspoken timer, which is all of the soldiers that are at the Trelleborg are asleep, but they still need to eat and drink. So they are basically, you know, starving to death as they are sleeping. So it's not so much that everyone knows that they can't take another night. It's that nobody really knows how much time they have.
Yeah.
So it did kind of add a question mark of should we do this or shouldn't we? So
yeah,
it was interesting. There were these little thorny goblin like fae that can shift through the walls of the maze that attack them. This would have been a challenging encounter. I was slightly worried about it, except I managed to not roll above a 5 for 90% of the session.
It's funny because I've talked quite a bit about playing Selena, my fighter from the Cygnus Dior game. My paladin is feeling a little like that. She only has an 18 AC, but at second level, that's still pretty beefy. So she basically stood at one end of this corridor and was a bottleneck, and they couldn't hit her. She couldn't hit them, but they couldn't hit her. And meanwhile, everyone else dealt with taking them out.
And then I triumphantly rolled high, but the paladin, now that she's second level, has her combat ability where she can use her bonus action to brace her shield.
Yep.
So I had to roll that with disadvantage.
Yep.
That second roll came up a 5 again.
I will say we played this on the afternoon of the day I ran my game in the evening, and my Tales of the Margrave game is also using Tales of the Valiant. So I was able to point some of these features out to my players, especially like the ranger, because I'm like, this is a thing you can do.
Mm-hmm. And honestly, I mean, I joke about that, but I did like the feel that like that felt like what a paladin should be doing. Like, I am going to stand up here and you guys get ready. They're just going to like run up against my shield and bounce off of it until you guys are ready to do something.
Yeah, very much so.
I liked it. We're still in the middle of the maze. It's also kind of neat in the VTT because you can just stop and like that's where they're at in the maze. Like there's no worrying about putting the map up or taking a picture of it or anything like that. It's just we know where they left off.
Yep.
Hooray. This is me like from, you know, 10 years ago, me would have been going, VTT, that's terrible. How do you ever get used to that? Now I'm like, yeah, that's way easier.
And of course, we are not going to be able to play in the month of February.
Yep.
Well, I can't do this weekend. I can't do that weekend. I can't. It's like, oh, my God, people. I did tell them all they could play on the weekend I wasn't available that they were considering, but they were like, no, we'll wait. So we won't get to play again until early March.
I don't know how long it'll take us to get there, but there is a nice set of lower level adventures that kind of roll into the setting. And that's part of why I wanted to use this setting, because they do kind of, it's not so much an adventure path, but they all kind of key off of the previous one. So I like that. And that's why we were kind of doing that.
Yeah.
So I really want to at least get to the end of this one. So maybe we can look at doing the second adventure in the series.
Oh, the other thing I got to do with my paladin is I got to smite on a crit.
Yes.
That was glorious. I think that was on the Puka.
It was against the Puka. But honestly, the Puka should have been, again, that one should have been a little bit nastier fight. But I mean, it stood up to a smite from you and it didn't wither right after that fight. It was still another couple rounds, but it just couldn't hit.
Welcome to the Dungeon Master's Workshop.
Moving on into our Dungeon Master's Workshop. The concept of different types of players has been moving around the RPG community for many, many years. In the 2024 Dungeon Master's Guide, these are laid out as 8 types of player motivation, while the Tales of the Valiant Game Master Guides identifies 6 player archetypes. All of these come from the original work on player types done by Robin Laws back in 2002 in Robin's Laws for Good Game Mastering. These archetypes have become ubiquitous to role-playing discussions, so we wanted to dive in and look at what they bring to the table. So let's start off with breaking down what these types are. What are the types that Robin Laws outlined?
So the original ones that Robin Laws talks about are the power gamer, the butt kicker, the tactician, the specialist, the storyteller, and the casual gamer. And it's very interesting because it was only a couple of years ago when I listened to the audiobook of this, because there is an audiobook of it, if you would like to listen to Robin's Laws of Good Game Mastering, which is kind of interesting. But it is funny feeling that difference between where we are at now and what 2002 was like, because there are still some things that kind of assume some things about RPGs in 2002 that you would not necessarily assume now. For example, the fact that 50% of the player base, according to WotC, is women, and he's still kind of making these comments about your casual gamer may be somebody's girlfriend, so you should make a good impression on them.
You know, it's I can tell I'm old because 2002 doesn't feel like it was that long ago.
I know.
That was 23 years ago.
There are adults that were not born at that point in time.
My current gaming group that I have been gaming together with for 21 years did not exist in 2002. So, yeah, it's hard to keep track of things. Let's take a moment and talk about the differences between these types, because some of them sound pretty similar. Like, obviously, the casual gamer is, that's the person who comes to hang out and play, but, you know, they're there because their friends are there.
Yeah.
But what's the difference between the power gamer and the butt kicker?
The way it's kind of framed is the power gamer is the person that wants to know everything they are doing is optimal. They don't just want to get into a fight. They want to know that if they get into a fight, that they have the right feat and the right magic item, and they took the right action every time they're attacking, so that they have, you know, this higher curve of everything they're doing being what they should be doing for the character choices they took. The butt kicker doesn't necessarily care if they're optimized. They just like combat.
And what about the tactician and the specialist?
The tactician is somebody that kind of likes, and this is what's interesting, because some of these types can be good or evil.
We'll get into that.
The tactician is really somebody that likes making sure that everybody is working together to do things like, oh, you know, you have a thing that will get past their resistance. You should make sure to use that next time. Or, you know, I'm going to buff you so that you can do this thing. They're not necessarily trying to optimize themselves, but they are trying to make sure that everything is flowing well and everybody is kind of contributing to situations.
And the specialist?
The specialist in here, it's really funny because some of these were very much kind of like broad categories. This one is just, this is the person that likes to play one type of character and they will play that type of character. I play Dwarven Fighters. That's what I play forever, all the time. Don't make me try and play something else.
Yeah, and that also, I think, gives away the age of this list a little bit, because I used to know those types of people.
Yeah, I don't see that as much anymore.
Yeah, I'm sure they still exist, but I have not gamed with anybody in years who is like, I only play X. Mm-hmm. Everyone has their favorites. Like, mm-hmm. Everyone knows that Ange likes to play rogues. Mm-hmm. And Jared likes to play Rangers, mm-hmm. but we obviously play plenty of other types of characters.
Yeah, I'll play a bard. I'll play a cleric. It doesn't, you know, I'm not really locked into one thing. It's just sort of like, if it works, I will play my favorite.
I think one of the other interesting things about Robin Law's list is that this is a lot about the mechanics. There's not a lot here about the narrative engagement with the game other than the storyteller.
Right. And the whole thing about the storyteller is that is somebody that really wants to know the backstory for why you're doing things. Like, why is this dungeon here? Who is this pile of bones that we found at the entrance of the dungeon? You know, they want the details to the setting and the adventure that you're playing. It is interesting because Robin Laws has done a lot of talking about RPGs and the mm-hmm. meta structure of it and talking about story beats and everything. But yeah, this 2002 era, there was a lot of very, this is how people interact with or don't interact with the rules. You know, it's where a lot of this qualification comes from.
2002 is also the absolute height of the original D20 boom.
Oh, yeah.
So pretty much every game out there on the market was D20 based, using that third edition open game license in kind of that same structure of play.
And what's funny is, this was not a game specific resource, but it was published by Steve Jackson Games. So you're talking about the company that does GURPS.
Yeah.
Another very mechanics heavy game.
This is getting a little deeper into the weeds on the history of role-playing games, but I think you can kind of point to the D20 bust which happens in 2003 when Wizards of the Coast drops 3.5,
mm-hmm.
To being a point of change of crossing the Rubicon, so to speak, where a lot of companies lost their businesses because they suddenly weren't able to sell products because the game they were selling products for was no longer compatible with them. A lot of people became disillusioned with the sudden change. And as a result, people started investing more time in creating their own systems. You have the divergence of the indie community creating all of their games, including mm-hmm. the one a lot of people know, Powered by the Apocalypse games, and the OSR community going back to their roots and being like, I don't want to play like that. I want to get back to players doing their things. And, you know, like, I'm sorry, OSR people. I've played some of your games. It's generally not my jam, but I love you. And them going off and kind of doing, you know, their own thing. So I think that's kind of a point of, you know, I think it's important to look at the fact that this list came out at a time when the gaming industry and community was very much focused on one thing.
It's also really interesting because if you look at like Game Master guides at the time, it wasn't that there wasn't advice for running games, but you didn't have companies going into this like, this is what your players want. This is how you should tailor games to these players. Mm-hmm. You didn't have that kind. It was more a matter of make sure you're keeping the pacing going. Make sure you're being fair. Make sure it was more like everyone. It's almost the assumption that everyone that comes to the table in Dungeons and Dragons or Pathfinder had the same mindset. And you were just trying to be the best GM for the mindset that they are assumed to bring.
Yeah.
And that kind of started to shift a little bit because even like by the time Pathfinder put out their Game Master Guide, they had a version of these player types in there. Wizards of the Coast hired Robin Laws to write for the Dungeon Master's Guide 2 to expound on some of this stuff in there. So there is a really interesting change when you hit like 2008, 2009 and how things started to evolve at that point too.
Well, let's break down what the modern games have done. What has Wizards done in the 2024 D&D Dungeon Master's Guide, and what has Kobold Press done in Tales of the Valiant in regards to these archetypes?
In the 2024 DMG, they frame these a little bit less like this is a player type and more like this is a motivation that a player could have. And the motivations that they came up with were acting, exploring, fighting, instigating, optimizing, problem solving, socializing, and storytelling. And the Tales of the Valiant archetypes were the actor, the explorer, the inventor, the power gamer, the watcher, and the wild card.
So let's break those down. What does the Dungeon Master's Guide mean by those motivations?
So your actor is the person that very much likes being in character and framing things through how their character thinks and reacts to things. Maybe not as much worrying about all aspects of the story, but this is what my character would do in this situation. So that's how I want to view things and react to things. My character would not go to this inn because it's a grubby inn. I am refusing to stay here. I'm going to look for the expensive one. That type of thing.
I also imagine it's the person who just likes getting into character and interacting as their character at the table.
Mm-hmm. Exploring is basically finding out new stuff. That is a more of a general thing, but it is sort of like that whole, we don't know what's in this dungeon. Let's find out. We don't know who this NPC actually is. We just have this weird nickname for them. Let's find out. It's that feeling that if there is anything that is kind of mysterious, they want to find out more details about it.
I think we can easily say the fighter, you know,
yeah.
they like punching things in the face,
yes,
or stabbing them.
I think it's interesting that they have added the instigator in here. That is absolutely true. If you were to ask me something that wasn't on the Robin Laws list, that is something that I see very often in gaming groups, it is an instigator. And it's just basically somebody that everything is too quiet. I am going to do something.
Yeah. Yeah. I believe the Misdirected Mark folks used to call them rainmakers. They're the person that if you leave them alone long enough, they're going to do something. On one hand, you as a GM probably aren't going to have to do as much prep work because they're going to make something happen, but you usually still have to scramble, you know, like that railroad track, throwing it down as you're going because you don't know which direction they're going, but you got to keep it moving.
And after that, we had the optimizing motivation, which that one's pretty self-evident. That goes back to the power gamer. It is interesting how many of these are a little less judgmental in how they're framing things than the original version of them. Optimizing, you're just looking for the best possible combination of things because that's how you enjoy things. Problem solving is, it's not necessarily like you always like, puzzles or traps, but it is like, I am approaching the situation and I'm trying to figure out the best way to resolve it.
Mm-hmm.
Even if it's not combat, it is, wait, we talked to this one person. If we pay them enough, they might talk to this person for us and we don't even have to deal with it. It's that sort of like working through the details.
It's kind of another aspect of the explorer, like figuring out the mysteries of a setting.
Mm-hmm.
I think the problem solver enjoys the other aspect of those. Rather than just finding out what's going on, they like coming out with the best, cleverest solution for dealing with it.
It's a little more outcome-based. I want to find out about things, but I have an endpoint designed to work backwards from. Socializing, I like this one too, because it isn't just the casual gamer so much as it is saying, this is somebody that draws energy from being there with their friends, seeing their friends enjoying this game. That is the main reason that they're there.
I think the storyteller's pretty straightforward.
The difference between that and the actor is the storyteller likes setting details. This is the kind of player, like, if you ask an actor, like, tell me one patron that's at this bar, they may not want to do that. The storyteller, if you say, tell me one patron at this bar, well, there is Giovanni, who 10 years ago lost his wife and then remarried.
I think we'll get into this shortly. But I think you can break it down as the person who is motivated by acting is enjoying playing their character, whereas the person who is motivated by storytelling is more engaged with the story of the game as a whole.
Yes. And this is another thing. If you want to go into like the Misdirected Mark archives on this, they go into like layers of the game and, whether somebody is engaging on the personal level or on the story level or on the mechanical level.
Yeah.
That's a little beyond what we're talking about here, but that is very much kind of that difference between the storyteller and the actor.
Let's touch on the Tales of the Valiant archetypes then, because these are fewer than both other lists.
Yeah. The actor, I mean, that one pretty much matches up with, the acting motivation. The Explorer, that one's another one that, matches up the same. And the other thing that I would like to point out is that the Tales of the Valiant Game Master's Guide came out a little bit before the DMG. This isn't like anyone was copying anyone else. This is kind of how these archetypes have developed over years of people talking about them and refining them. And
yeah, if anything, they're quote unquote copying Robin Laws.
Right.
But even then, they're not copying what he wrote. They're taking how what he wrote has been expounded upon and recontextualized and re-understood in the modern gaming age 23 years later.
Yeah, and it goes way into the weeds, but I even when I was researching this, that Robin Laws actually refined that from an article that was written in 1980.
Oh.
From some gaming magazine. So, I mean, all of this is refinement. It is not brand new.
Yeah.
But the inventor is almost similar to the problem solver. What they're saying by inventing is you're not necessarily trying to come up with the most straightforward way to resolve something, but you are engaged in kind of figuring out, if we do this, then this will happen. This is a problem that we have. If we do this, it might interact with that problem and make it easier to deal with. That's what the inventor in this is talking about. Power gamer, I mean, that goes back to the optimizer. It is interesting that it kind of creeps back into slightly more judgmental language in this one than it did in the DMG. The Watcher just pretty much lines up with the socializing in the DMG.
Mm-hmm.
And the Wild Card is very much the same archetype as the instigating motivation.
Yeah. The interesting thing is Tales of the Valiant doesn't have the combat monster. Other than if you look at the power gamer being the one to optimize their character for combat, they don't have the person that's just there to punch evil in the face.
It is interesting because if you read those sections in the Tales of the Valiant Game Master's Guide, there's almost the degree to which people like getting into combat or role-playing is less in this about the character, the player archetypes, and is more just a general discussion about how much players like to engage in different pillars of the game. So they kind of removed that from this and assumed that each one of these archetypes could be more or less invested in specifically being in combat a lot.
Let's move on and like talk about, are people really this cut and dry? You know, do people actually fit into just one of these categories? Because I certainly don't think I'm any one of these alone. I mean, I absolutely love to get into my character and have a great scene where I'm acting as my character. I also love the storytelling and, you know, pushing along the larger narrative of the game. I play these games to be the big damn hero and punch evil in the face.
Mm-hmm.
And if you've heard me talk about my in-person games recently, I definitely am a socializer.
Mm-hmm.
So, like, let's talk about how cut and dry these categories are.
One of the things that I wanted to touch on is almost all of these sources will say nobody is 100% one thing. But then when you read through them, there's not a lot of talking about somebody might be this and this, and this is how you reconcile that. They still kind of still engage the topic as in this is what this player is. Even if they're thinking that player may not be that same thing every time they show up at the table, they're still kind of addressing it as today I am an explorer. And it's like, what about this minute?
Yeah. And as we were going through these, a thought kind of occurred to me. Some of the language in the original description from Robin Law's original book has a fair amount of judgment.
Mm-hmm.
In these categories. And some of these categories are associated with problem players. But as I was thinking about it, it tends to be the player who only focuses on that style of play that becomes the problem. Because a person who is only fixated on role-playing their character, doing what their character would do, focused in only that actor category, can be as much of a problem as the combat monster who tries to turn every conversation into a fight.
Yeah.
I have shame to admit that I have made fun of actors before as role players, because sometimes you get one of those players at your table and they're absolutely infuriating because it's what my character would do. And it's like, I don't care what your character would do. The rest of the game is doing this. It's the players who like are only in one of these slots, so to speak, that tends to like exemplify a problem with that style of play being the only style of play.
When you're talking about that, when somebody is so focused on just being one thing, I think we have all encountered the player that does the Leroy Jenkins thing where it's like, hey, we're negotiating with this monster. Maybe we don't need to fight it. Wham! Roll initiative!
Yeah. I've had some issues with the concept of the Rainmaker because I've seen some Rainmakers that make me not want to stay at that table, you know, because it's like, there goes my fun because now we have to deal with that.
Yeah. And that's what's really interesting is I think you're right. It's the degree to which these are problems are the degree to which somebody remains in a silo and does not interact with any of the other motivations.
I have some old school players at my table who are so concerned about being accused of being a power gamer that they will sometimes purposefully not optimize their character.
Yeah.
And it's like, no. Like, let's make your character effective. Let's, you know, it's like, but I don't want to be a power gamer. I don't want to be accused of being a munchkin or anything. It's like, no, you're not going to be a munchkin. I know that's not what you are, but let's make your character powerful. Let's make them useful, you know? So
we had a player, speaking of when someone is very much in their mindset and it doesn't necessarily gel with the rest of the party, we had a player in our Princes of the Apocalypse game where he was playing an Asmar sorcerer, and it was a divine soul sorcerer. So originally he was going to be the healer in the group and then decided he liked throwing fireballs.
I mean, I can't blame him there.
No. But we were very beat up after a fight, but he had just manifested his Asmar wings that last a minute, and he proceeded to kite every encounter in the hallway back to this room because he didn't want to waste his manifestation. And the rest of us are all like, we are going to murder you after this is done. I don't care if you only got to use it for 4 rounds. We were not prepared for this.
We agree that most players are not any one of these archetypes.
Mm-hmm.
You know, usually they're gonna be a mix. My table tends to, like, people like getting into character and role-playing. Most of them are really great at the overarching story. Some of them want to get into the combat. All of the, you know, like, the problem solving. There are mixes of these.
Mm-hmm.
And I love just the teeniest little bit of the wild card instigator to keep things moving and keep me on my toes.
Mm-hmm.
But why should we bother to know any of this if nobody is any one thing? What does understanding player motivations and archetypes do for us as GMs and players?
I think the interesting thing is that sometimes it tells us where our players' heads are at. And I think we have all had those sessions or had players at those sessions where they have had a very rough week,
mm-hmm.
and they want to beat something into submission. That is not necessarily what they are normally, but this week was especially bad. So they want to hit something until it has no more hit points.
Yeah.
And that is a thing that it's important to understand because that's not their normal thing. Like, they could be somebody that is very into, you know, role playing and investigating and doing all of this in depth stuff. But this one time, you know, they need to be able to just hit something with their sword over and over again.
Back in the early days of the pandemic, when my groups switched to playing online primarily, I would factor in an hour and a half to 2 hours of us just sitting there chit-chatting because all of us needed that human connection and we needed the socialization that gaming gives us. And the actual game was like, yeah, we all wanted to play. We all needed that little bit of engagement, but the primary purpose for all of us getting together was the socialization.
Well, and the thing that's interesting to me, too, is that this is why I like the fact, especially that the 2024 DMG kind of made these less judgmental, is I have been super invested in RPGs for decades. But when I reach a certain point to where, like, my week has just been too much and I am dealing with too much, I fall into the socializing thing.
Mm-hmm.
I am not a casual gamer. But I am just going to sit here, and if you need me to heal you, I'll heal you. I'm here. I'm enjoying being with all of my friends right now.
Yeah.
But I'm not engaging any higher than that because I can't, because I've just overloaded on everything else that's going on.
Chris has been making fun of me for being a super socializer when I get together with my groups in person. And it's the, I am what I would consider a hardcore RPG player.
Mm-hmm.
I do 2 podcasts. I write for a blog. Well, I haven't written in a while, but I write for a blog. I think about it all the time. I craft my own adventures for conventions and all of this. I've written an adventure that's going to get published. I'm fairly hardcore at this, but you get me in a room with my friends and pass the cookies.
I had some players that back when all of the adventures for D&D were more seasons and, like, the AL adventures all revolved around them and kind of added more context to the adventures and everything. I had players that were playing in Storm King's Thunder, but then I ran one of the AL adventures that's kind of on the outskirts. And that adventure had a lot more of the backstory of the Ordning and how some of the giant kin that aren't the major giants fit into the Ordning and everything. And they were, like, super invested in this because up to that point, the main campaign they've been playing, and they were just like, there's a bunch of giants going wild. I don't get it. So that's a case where you had a lot of characters that are now falling into that storytelling or investigating area because now something is interesting to them and it's making other things click. And that's not the mode that they were in for most of this other campaign.
Yeah. And I think in general, understanding these aspects helps us know what to bring to the table.
Yes.
Whether as a player or a GM. As a GM, you want to make sure that your players are enjoying your game. If you have any degree of empathy, you want your players to enjoy the game you're running.
Yes.
That means giving them a game they're going to enjoy.
And honestly, I think empathy is a big deal about this because paying enough attention to your players that you recognize what they are and what they might be in the moment is a big step towards understanding, being empathetic to the people that you're hanging out with.
So let's talk about putting some tools into play. As GMs, how do we adapt how we're running the game based on the types of players we've got at the table?
One of the things is that I think what doesn't always get brought across in some of these discussions is you're really trying to balance different types, because if two people aren't in the same headspace, you don't want to give one person everything they want completely to the point to where it's detrimental to the other people at the table.
Yeah, like I was talking about how I've had some situations where I have played with instigators and they end up snatching the fun of what I was about to do out of my hands because the game now has to adapt to the chaos they're creating.
Yeah.
And as a GM, you have to be very mindful of that happening because you want to make sure both players are getting some enjoyment out of the game. And sometimes that might mean telling that instigator, hang on, I'll get to you in a moment. Let's finish this scene over here. Or even just having the meta conversation of, hey, is everyone okay if the game starts veering off in this direction if we do this? Do you give consent that this is going to happen?
Yeah, and this is a thing that I think is really important that has been as much of a development as anything when it's talking about these player types. And that is, boy, back in 2002, weren't we like still worried about, I don't want to act like we're playing a game. I don't want to stop everyone and say, are we okay with it going this direction? As long as we're playing in the game, we need to fix things in the game. If you're doing something bad, I need to punish you with an NPC instead of stopping the game and saying, hey, are we all good with this? Maybe we shouldn't do this way.
There are still a lot of people out there who think that way.
Yeah.
I've been in a couple of Facebook groups recently that offer advice, and there are a lot of people that offer that really bad advice about how to fix a problem with in-character consequences to, you know, bad player behavior. And it's like, don't do that.
Yeah.
Nobody's going to enjoy that. It's just going to be a headache for you as a GM. The player's going to be upset because they don't understand why they're being punished.
Mm-hmm.
The other players are still going to have to deal with, like, have an out-of-character conversation about what's going on in the game. So the game is supposed to be fun for everyone.
Yes. For example, to look at the player types again, when you have that person that is the butt kicker or the fighter or whatever you want to call it, when they get to the end of a fight and you have prisoners that decide, I'm going to, you know, coup de grace all of them. And at this point, the fight is over. And that person that is a role player really wants to talk to these people because there's still some of them left alive. And I have seen that turn into a conflict because it's almost like the person thinks, well, since this was part of a fight, I am still in control of the scene. I am still controlling the direction of this. So I am going to kill them. And it's like,
right.
That's when you need to realize, no, this is a transition from what you were getting out of this to what somebody else is going to get out of this.
We're kind of already talking about this, but how do you deal with it when you have a mix of player types at the table, especially when those types are kind of in conflict? Because I don't think it's always a bad thing.
No, because if everybody wants to do one thing, sometimes it might be good for most of the people that want to do that one thing. Let me put it this way. For me as a GM, if everyone I have at the table just wants to fight all the time, I am not going to enjoy that as much because I don't want to run fight after fight after fight after fight. I want to frame this as some kind of narrative. I want to give some personality to things. Even if nothing else, this is one of those places where you need to remember as the GM, you are also a player and you should be enjoying this.
Yes, absolutely.
This is one of those things too, where it's important in your session zero to talk about what tone you want the campaign to have, because I think sometimes you have people that think, oh, I could come to the table, show up every once in a while and just beat the crap out of things. But if you explain, I would like to role play a little bit more, that person might go, hey, that does sound good. And they will get out of that mindset of thinking, oh, this is just going to be us, you know, dungeon crawling and killing everything and managing inventory.
Yeah. I generally in session zero tell my players that I am running this because I expect you to be the big damn heroes.
Mm-hmm.
I don't expect murder hobos. I expect you to engage with the story as much as engage with the combat.
Mm-hmm.
I love a good combat as much as everyone. At the same time, I want the story, and I'm always going to approach things with a degree of in-character empathy and trying to understand what's going on. I've probably frustrated Marin's player more than once in our Marodi game when Kazina has questioned, why do we need to kill something? Because it lives here. It's doing its thing, you know. Anyway,
I think that's interesting too, because sometimes it's important to see where the Venn diagrams overlap, because, you know, to use some of the things that they're talking about here, your exploring person and your problem solving person probably both want details on something.
Mm-hmm.
It's just, they want them for different reasons. Like the exploring person just wants details. They want more texture to something. Whereas the problem solver is looking for an outcome, but where they align, they are still going to be looking for the same thing. And I think at times it's good, if you think that I am catering this towards my problem solver, you should also realize, hey, I should also check in with my explorer person and say, hey, are you getting the details that you want out of this? Because some of these details aren't relevant to a problem, but they are more details.
I think, too, it can be an incredible thing to have a mix of these types at the table when all the players are working with the understanding of this game is for everyone. We're all here to have fun. And that's when you can let the person whose focus that day is in one particular area take the lead in the storytelling or instigating the combat or, you know, solving a puzzle or trying to figure out the mystery or just chit-chatting and passing the cookies.
Mm-hmm.
If you have all these things working in concert together, that can be good for the whole table, you know, and for the GM.
As we're talking about this, and we're talking about how nobody is one thing, someone may primarily be a few things, but a lot of times it's not even just one thing. Like I was thinking about my Curse of Strahd game. I have someone that is an instigator, fighter, problem solver. I have someone that is a socializer, storyteller. I have someone that is a fighter, explorer, problem solver. I have a socializer that's more of an explorer, and I have a socializer that's more of an instigator, where she will just kind of sit there and drink everything in, and then halfway through the session, she pokes something.
Going back to where we were talking about how the problem players tend to be the ones who are just one type of thing, I think that problem ends up coming down to a degree of selfishness, because they are there for their fun at the table and don't, you know, either don't have the maturity or the understanding enough to realize that the game is good if everyone is having fun.
I don't want to just frame this as just the players doing something bad, because there are times when you expect someone to be one thing and you don't allow for them to be more than one thing, that you start to encourage them to only be one thing.
Right.
Like when you decide this person is the fighter, and you always throw combat things at them, and you always bring up stuff that they're going to want to fight, you may be pushing them into one aspect of what they like, but not exploring the fact that they kind of like some of these other things too.
I was thinking about this even as I complained about the instigator doing something that takes away my fun. I have been the instigator before. You know, I have been the this is a now problem person.
Yes. It was fun, but yes.
I will actually, I'll find the link and put it in the show notes so it can be shared. But there is a gentleman out there who did a parody of Katy Perry's Firework to Fireball and did a whole song about it. And, you know, it was shared in one of our mutual chat groups. And I'm like, oh, yeah, this is a now problem. That was Sapphire. See, I'm tired of these people talking and debating about whether we're going to deal with this situation. Let's just deal with it. But that's if it had turned out that the other players are like, oh, hell no. No. It would have been like, okay, she stops before she casts it or whatever. It was obvious that the players were on the precipice of engaging with this combat right now. And it's just like, let's just deal with it.
It was more of a, do we want to try and be stealthy and spend a little bit more time planning it? Or do we just want to roll initiative now? That was not a dramatic difference.
You can still be an instigator and respect everyone else at the table. You just gotta talk with folks. Does the size of your table matter in all of this? The size of your table.
Oh, yes. One of the most important things for GMs, I think, I beg of you, is to learn how many people you can handle at a table.
Mm-hmm.
And do not start trying to find out, can I run for 12 people? Go the other direction. Start with 4 people and figure out, okay, I can handle 4. Maybe I can handle 5. at some point you start realizing, and I think, I mean, this is a whole other topic too, but I think it's relevant here, because the more player types you have and the more combination of player types you have, the more you may be stressed out trying to make sure everybody is getting what they want in equal portions. So I think it's really important to understand how many people you can run for. I used to run Pathfinder for 7 people, and that was a massive emotional drain for me.
Yeah, I used to run for 8 at conventions because I thought that was what you should do, because that's what I knew from the late 80s, early 90s. And it didn't have, there was a convention organizer who would be like, hey, your games are really popular. Can you add 2 more seats? And, you know, originally when he first started doing that, I'd be like, yeah, sure, I can run for 2 more. And it's like, no, the game might still be fun for everyone, but it's not focused enough for everyone, at least with the way I run.
Mm-hmm.
I find that I don't like small tables.
Mm-hmm.
I don't like less than 4 players because the game moves too quick. There's not enough space for me as a GM to just sit back and let the players chew on the scenery. I have to be on more.
Yeah.
So I don't like a small table. 4 is the minimum. Our Coriolis campaign, I will run for 3 because sometimes we don't have all 4 players and I don't want to keep kicking the can down the road. But most of the time, 4 is the minimum I'll run for.
Mm-hmm.
I like 6. I find 6 to be a good fit, especially if the players are a good fit.
And that's actually funny, because as you bring that up, you don't want too big a table, but you are correct. You don't necessarily want too small a table, because I will admit there are times when I do get into that mode where it's like I'm kind of shutting down. I need to socialize more and not, you know, be on all the time. And the fewer players you have, the less your players can do that.
Mm-hmm.
And then it's like, I really just wanted to be helper monkey this session and not have to contribute a whole lot other than just helping people out. And now I have to be the person leading the investigation, or I have to be the person, you know, doing this, because we don't have that many people at the table. So yeah, it cuts both directions.
I found out that I have trouble with small tables.
Mm-hmm.
Quite a few years ago, I was running a Doctor Who game at a small convention, and I only had 2 players show up, and I'm like, I don't want to tell these folks no, because it's going to be too hard to get into anything else at this hour, so I'll just run for them. And the game normally took about 3.5 hours, and I think we finished in under 2.
Yeah.
And it's partially because when I run, I leave space for the players to engage with each other, to engage with the setting, the NPCs, the scenery, and there just wasn't enough of that with only 2 players at the table.
Mm-hmm.
And they both said they had fun, but I was like, oh, okay, this is something that I struggle with, coming up with enough to fill a normal length session for just 2 players.
Well, and I also think it's really interesting to look at your expectations going in, because I think we have an easier time running with 2 people for Heroes of Havel's Way, because that game was never going to be more than 2 people and Chris running it for us.
Right.
So that was the assumption right from the start. So we kind of know each one of those sessions, we're both on stage constantly.
Right.
It's not going to be something where we take a backseat to somebody else, but we know that going in. And that's different than expecting 4 or 5 people to show up and only getting 3, and then having to change your energy that was already geared towards a larger table that was going to have a little bit more ability to move around people.
Yeah. And my Wednesday night fate game was only 2. It's kind of on hiatus right now for reasons, general hand wave at the state of the world. They're short sessions. It's 2 hours. That 2 hours works out to be a good amount of time for the GM and us 2 players to engage with things, feel like we're doing something, getting it. Whereas 2 hours with a 5 or 6 person group, that feels like, why are we bothering? What are we doing here?
Yeah. That Princes of the Apocalypse game that I mentioned, we had, I think, 8 people at that table, which I was a player, so I didn't have to run that one. But it did feel like a 4-hour session sometimes felt like I barely got to do anything.
I mean, that's probably a whole other topic, veering away from player types here.
Yeah.
Have you ever had a time when you were convinced a player was one type and then they suddenly seemed to be doing something else completely different?
Well, this has been interesting, having run a lot of games at the local game store, I had a player. He was in a lot of games. He was kind of quiet most of the time. If he rolled something and his dice came up bad, he would cuss, and that was kind of the degree to which he actually interacted with anything. A lot of times people didn't even know what the character was he was playing. And the thing was, what we found out when I had the patience to talk to him and ask him and stop everything and say, hey, did you want to do something before we moved on or something like that? He didn't like having the spotlight on him where he had to come up with story elements, but he did react much better knowing that everything slowed down enough that he wasn't going to get missed.
Mm-hmm.
He was a lot more engaged with the story than people realized. He just wasn't. It's funny. He was almost like he was a socializer that was also a storyteller. You just weren't going to get that from interacting with him unless you gave him the space to interact with you first.
That can be a whole other topic, talking about players' level of engagement,
mm-hmm.
because that is separate from this topic.
Yeah.
Not every player is going to be able to advocate for themselves enough to like demand the time to have the spotlight, you know, or you have the opposite where you have the player who's just going to steamroll ahead holding that spotlight, even if they don't realize that's what they're doing, and everyone else is just kind of swept along in their wake.
I do think, too, I could be wrong, but I have to think that it is kind of a GM thing that most GMs run into, that the person you didn't think was ever going to be bloodthirsty sometimes will have that moment where their character is just like, no, I am going to unload everything I have on this person, and I want to see them dead.
Yep, you will see that on occasion.
I had that moment with my doctor in your Coriolis game.
Yeah, you did. I have a player who has always been, I wouldn't call them so much of an actor, but they engage with the story of the game. But I found I could not put them on the spot to come up with story elements. They froze.
Mm-hmm.
And they didn't like it. As part of that, they didn't like losing control of their character. Like, if the narrative took control of their character away from them to any degree, they got very defensive.
Mm-hmm.
And I was like, oh, okay, I need to be aware of this dynamic with this particular player.
Yeah.
Especially if you're gaming with the same, if you're gaming with your friends, which I recommend gaming with your friends. There's nothing wrong with gaming with strangers. That's also something I recommend to do on occasion. Mm-hmm. But your regular group should be your friends, the people you care about, you like outside of the game. You want to figure out what they enjoy so you can help facilitate that.
Mm-hmm.
So let's wrap this all up. What does this all mean? Do we really need to know about player types and motivations? What does it get us as GMs or as players? I mean, we've covered this a lot, but let's sum it up.
Looking back at the original way that Robin Laws framed this is kind of interesting, because he had this grid in the book that was like, here is your player type, or here is your player, this is their player type, here is what you should give them. And he's telling you to write this out as a grid so that you have it in front of you and you remember, oh yeah, I have to throw something at this person so they can punch it. And I'm thinking that's not a bad idea, but not that way. I think it's actually almost more useful to look at your scenes and to know this scene will appeal to an instigator, this scene will appeal to a problem solver, instead of assuming that your player is that one type and it will only appeal to them.
Right.
Because then when you have your person that works in counseling and has had a really bad week and she loves investigating things, but now she wants to stab something in the throat, you realize she will be equally happy with this session that the other person that likes to punch things with her monk is going to be happy with.
And I think it's good in general to have a balance of these types of things in your game. If your game is just one rolling combat to the next rolling combat, that may engage a certain segment of your players, but it's eventually going to get old,
mm-hmm.
except for the diehard combat monster. So you want to mix things up. And I mean, that helps with pacing in general.
Mm-hmm.
If you even care about the narrative story of your game as a whole. So yeah. Like having these different elements can help make your game more engaging, and it can help satisfy the various different types of players.
I'll also say, I think of all of these ones that we looked at, I like how the 2024 DMG framed it as motivations instead of making it just an archetype for a player.
Yeah.
Because that kind of reminds you that it is something that drives someone, but it is not that person.
Exactly. I think all of this also leads itself to a point I think is important for us as players of RPGs, regardless of whether we're GMs or playing a character, is understanding what you like.
Mm-hmm.
It is really important to dig down and find out the type of game you enjoy so you know what to go look for in the games you are playing. This doesn't mean to not try new things. Mm-hmm. It just means if you understand what you enjoy, if you understand that you enjoy the storytelling and you enjoy the acting, but you also need to have an opportunity to punch a bad guy in the face because you can't do it in real life, that's fine. It's a good thing to understand that, and you can know what to ask for when you talk about the type of game you want to play with your GM.
I agree.
Now let's join Ange and Jared for some downtime research, where they do the work so we don't have to.
Every episode, we're going to look for something related to D&D that we want to pass along to our listeners. It might be products, websites, videos, or podcasts, but it will always be something that we think will enhance your D&D experience. We also currently have a Patreon, so we are going to perform our Eldritch Invocation at this point in time. We have a Patreon now, so if you would like to help us do this show and provide us some additional content for you, we would love if you decided to join us. We've got our own Discord, and we'll be releasing additional supplementary material. And we had an example in here, but we've gone so far beyond this example now that we probably need to put other examples in there, because we've had campaign material from Heroes of Havel's Way. We've had monster stats that Chris has put in there. We're going to have subclass stats that he's going to put in there. I've made magic swords. I've had campaign templates. We've had a ton of stuff. So you will get stuff from us if you just join with us and bow to our whims. Wait, no, that's not quite what I wanted to say.
There might be something coming soon about lair actions.
There may be.
Very possibly. Since I am back to running a D&D-esque campaign again, I've been on the lookout for maps. I have a ton that I already downloaded from when I was running the Eberron game, but I'm very specifically looking for some more forest-style maps rather than jungle-style maps that'll fit for Tales of the Old Margreave. And one I found that I really like is Morvold Press on Patreon. I think pretty much all of the maps I used the other night were from them. They have a nice, clean style with just the right amount of detail and color that I like. They've got a whole bunch based on various adventures, so you can find, like, Map of Phandalin, a Map of Phandalin on Fire, Tribor Village, you can find Inn of the Last Home, some very, very good stuff. It is a Patreon, but I do believe they have some available for free members as well, so we'll have a link to that in the show notes.
Nice iconic locations in there, too.
Yeah.
My suggestion is going to be another one of these things that is just coming in under the wire, because by the time this comes out, you'll have like 3 or 4 days that you can go to the Kickstarter and back this. But I am going to mention the Sword Opera Kickstarter. It is a game that is being done by friends of the podcast network, Eli Kurtz and Eric Farmer. If you listen to Zhanghu Hustle, you have heard them talk about stories where there is a mysterious underground and people with extreme skills, some of which are supernatural. And this is a game about a world where there is an underground and people with extreme skills, some of which are supernatural. It is very much kind of taking some of those wushu type elements and also reframing them to be able to use them in other things. Like, for example, the baseline setting that they show you in the Ashcan is more of a almost like a Three Musketeers swashbuckling type thing, but with those same conceits in it. It's really neat. It is fantasy. It is more or less, it is a little bit more Forged in the Dark, but I really like it. I think you should check it out. We'll have a link to the Kickstarter. Look at it really quick, because you are only going to have a few days by the time this episode drops.
We are happily part of the Polygamers Podcast Network, helping you run and play your best games. We think you'll like another Polygamerist podcast like...
Panda's Talking Games. Queer gamers talking about tabletop role-playing games and making outtakes. Join Panda's Phil and Senda every other Wednesday answering listener questions about playing, running, and designing TTRPGs. It is like Car Talk, but for your games.
We have used up all of our resources, so I think it's time for a long rest. Maybe when we wake up, we'll be a different player type. I hope this adventure was rewarding for you. We hope you go exploring with us when we start our next adventure.